Lesson number 33 in the series of Old Testament survey over the book of Obadiah. In preparation, read the one chapter. In case you have a problem finding the book, it is near the end of the Old Testament, after Amos, but before the book of Jonah. Obadiah is the shortest book in the Old Testament, so it is hard to get much out of it. Did you notice there's absolutely no information about the prophet himself? There is nothing about his family, age, where he lives, or where he's speaking from. The name Obadiah was very common. So no matter how much detective work we do, there's nothing we can learn about the author. However, there are two historical clues that tell us when he wrote the book. According to verse 1, this book is about the nation of Edom. In verse 11, we are told that Jerusalem was invaded and Edom was involved. The books of Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and one of the Psalms tells us this happened during Babylon's attack in 586 BC. In verse 19, Obadiah says the Jews who are now scattered will once again live in the land. This means, as he is writing, they are not in the land. Exactly the situation in the 500s after Judah was exiled to Babylon. These clues tell us that Obadiah is writing after Judah has gone into exile, but when everyone still remembers the details. This would be somewhere between 585 and 580 BC. Although nothing is said about his location, we can assume, because Obadiah is a Jew, he's living in exile with the others. On the world scene, the Babylonian Empire is in control. The nation of Judah no longer exists. However, a nation just to the south is flourishing. Her name is Edom. Her boundaries run from the south end of the Dead Sea to the eastern arm of the Red Sea. Because of her location, she controls the southeastern crossroads of commerce. The King's Highway, a road that all eastern caravans use to travel north and south, goes right through her country. Another road in her country runs east and west, providing a route between Egypt, Arabia, and Babylon. These roads give Edom a tremendous advantage. She collects tolls from every caravan and trader who uses them. She also has first choice in selling or trading with the caravans. Or she can ambush and rob the caravans. She was known for her highway robbery. All of this has brought great prosperity to the nation of Edom. Her capital is just west of the King's Highway. In Hebrew, it was called Sela. In Greek, it was called Petra. Both words mean rock or cliff. The Bible usually calls it Mount Seir, S-E-I-R. This is the Hebrew word for rough or shaggy. This tells us her capital was on a rough or shaggy cliff. From this background, we now have the date of the book and the location of Edom. But to understand the book, we also need the history of Edom, where it came from, how it started. This takes us all the way back to Genesis, to some very well-known stories. In chapter 25 of Genesis, we are told about a couple named Isaac and Rebekah. They had twin boys, Jacob and Esau. Because Esau was born first, he had special rights and privileges known as the birthright. He would receive a double portion of the inheritance. This means The inheritance will be divided into three parts. He will get two parts, and his brother one part. The birthright also gives Esau leadership and responsibility over his brother and their families. But the most important part of Esau's birthright is the spiritual privilege. As an adult, he will be the spiritual leader, not just for his own family, but also for the entire family clan. And because he's from the line of Abraham and Sarah, the birthright gives Esau's descendants the right to the promised land and to become the family line of Jesus. These are the special rights and promises that have come down through Abraham, through Isaac, and now to be passed on to the firstborn, to Esau. When the boys grow up, this birthright creates a problem. Because it involves the promised land and the line of Jesus, it has to go to the person and family whose faith is in Yahweh God and who will continue this knowledge of Him. Esau has decided he's not interested in the God of his parents and grandparents. He has chosen to worship the pagan gods of the Canaanites, Baal, Ashtoreth, Molech. Jacob follows Yahweh God. So the birthright needs to go to him. But how? Esau was born first. He already has it. In the culture of that day, throughout the Middle East, it was common to buy and sell one's birthright. Archaeology has found records of a birthright sold for 3 sheep. The price of the birthright was determined by how much you thought it was worth, how much value you placed on it. According to Genesis 25, Esau felt his birthright was practically worthless. So he sold it, and Jacob bought it for a bowl of stew, a bowl of lentils. This was perfectly legitimate and part of their culture. However, another step was needed to activate the birthright or make it valid. Jacob had to receive a special blessing from his father near the time of his father's death. Instead of letting God arrange that part of it, Jacob got the blessing through deception and trickery. In this, he was totally wrong, and it was costly. It started a chain of events that would last almost 2,000 years. When Esau finds out how Jacob got the blessing, he becomes furious, bitter, and vengeful. When he threatens to kill his brother, Jacob immediately moves 500 miles to the north and lives with his uncle Laban for the next 20 years. During that time, he gets married and has a large family. After 20 years, he returns home. He gets together with Esau. They give each other expensive gifts, say nice things to each other, and appear to reconcile. Each settle down in their own territory. Jacob lives in the land God promised to Abraham, Isaac, and now him, because he has the birthright. Esau and his family move to the south and east of there. As time passes, he and the family clan take over the people and their land. According to Genesis chapter 25, verse 30, Esau has a nickname. Translated into English, it would be Red, the Hebrew word for Edom. Esau then names his new area after himself, calling it Edom. His descendants become known as the Edomites. Genesis chapter 32, verse 28, tells us Jacob also has another name. God gave him the name Israel, so his land was called Israel, and his descendants become known as the Israelites. Even though it looked like the brothers reconciled, Esau never forgave his brother Jacob. He kept all that bitterness and resentment inside of him and then passed it on to his family. The conflict started between Esau and Jacob, or to use their other names, between Edom and Israel. After many years, Jacob and his family clan moved to Egypt. Over the next 400 years, they end up in slavery. God then uses Moses to get them out. By this time, the family clan has become a nation. After 40 years, Moses is ready to lead the Jews into the Promised Land. They are in the Sinai Peninsula, just west of Edom, on the east-west road. Moses sends a message to the king of Edom, asking permission to go through Edom, so the Jews can get on the north-south King's Highway. This would save them weeks of travel and take them directly north to the east bank of the Jordan River. When the king sends back a message of no, Moses asks a second time, explaining they will pay for all the water they use. He promises not to touch their crops or food. However, the king of Edom still refuses. We have this story in Numbers chapter 20. The resentment and bitterness from their ancestor Esau is still there. The family feud is now a national feud between the Edomites and the Israelites. Another 800 years go by. Once again, there's a crucial encounter between these two nations. In fact, it is so traumatic that a prayer is written about it. Turn to Psalm 137. Psalm 137. This is a song written by a Jewish exile living in Babylon. Psalm 137, beginning with verse 1. By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion, Jerusalem. There on the poplars we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, "Sing us one of the songs of Zion." How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, and if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. Remember, O Lord, what the Edomites did on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundations. In 586, when Babylon came and destroyed Jerusalem, the Edomites were watching. They said to each other, "Oh, good! Let's hope Jerusalem and the nation of Judah is totally wiped out." A Jewish man is in the area. He hears and sees how they are involved. After he has been exiled to Babylon, he writes a psalm. He prays for God's justice, that God will remember and punish Edom for what she did. Some 5 years go by, and God responds to this man's prayer. He uses Obadiah to say, "I do remember what Edom did, and I will bring justice." The book of Obadiah is God's plans for Edom. It explains what he's going to do. Verses 1 through 16 say that Edom will be destroyed. Verses 17 through 21 says Judah will be restored. To put it another way, God, through the prophet Obadiah, says he is going to take Edom off the map and he will put the Jews back on the map. To appreciate what God says, we need to know about Edom's capital, the city of Petra. The only approach to Edom's capital is through a deep, winding gorge. Tall, huge cliffs going up 300 feet are on either side. After winding for over a mile, the gorge narrows to just 6 feet. On the other side is the valley floor, 1 mile by 3/4 of a mile. In the time of Edom, Petra was not built on the valley floor. It was on the north side of the valley, 1,000 feet up, on top of a large, shaggy cliff. Thinking of this geography, look at verses 3 and 4 in the book of Obadiah. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rocks and make your home on the heights. You who say to yourself, who can bring me down to the ground? Though you soar like the eagle and make your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. What an exact description. Petra, the capital, on top of the rock cliff mesa, 1,000 feet high, is like an eagle's nest, close to the stars. She is secure, knowing that just a handful of men can defend the 6-foot entrance into the valley floor. Even if the enemy does get through, the only way to the capital on the top of the rock cliff is through a secret passageway in the side of the cliff. From a human standpoint, Petra is totally secure. No one could bring her down. But God says in verse 4, I will bring you down. Since God is fair, he explains why he will do this to Edom. According to verse 3, he will do it because of her pride. For more than 1,000 years, with nations and empires all around her, Petra has survived. With this kind of history, she believes she can always take care of herself. She certainly would never need Yahweh, the God of the Jews. God is going to destroy her because of her pride. According to verse 10, another reason is because of the violence against your brother Jacob. Verses 11 through 14 describe the violence and how it progressed when Babylon had attacked the Jews. Verse 11, on the day you stood aloof, on the day you stood by. At first, Edom showed indifference. According to international law of that day, people with blood ties were obligated to help each other. International law of that time said if there were blood ties between nations, they were obligated to be allies. There certainly were blood ties between Edom and Israel, since they had descended from twin brothers. Edom broke international law. As Judah was being conquered, she stood by indifferently. That was bad enough. But then in verse 12, you should not look down on your brother in the day of his misfortune, nor rejoice over the people of Judah. Not only had the Edomites been indifferent, but then they were gleeful spectators. The last part of verse 13, you should not have seized their wealth in the day of their disaster. They had shared in the plunder. Verse 14, you should not have waited at the crossroads to cut down their fugitives, nor have handed over their survivors in the day of trouble. During the 2 years that Babylon had surrounded Jerusalem, many Jews had found ways to escape during the night. They immediately headed for the king's highway so they could go south as far as possible from the Babylonian Empire. The most logical direction was to head south. But Edom's soldiers were along the highway and used the opportunity to kill them. Other Jews they captured. No doubt they received a bounty price for each person they turned over to the Babylonians. So Edom had not only watched, she actually participated in Judah's destruction. This is why God is going to punish her. But how is he going to do it? Going back to verse 2, see, I will make you small among the nations. You will be utterly despised. Edom rejoiced when the nation of Judah was taken off the map and no longer existed. Now Edom will be made small and eventually will be taken off the map. Looking at a map today, there is no nation of Edom in the Middle East. There are no Edomites. God took her off the map. But later, God put the Jews back on the map. First, in 536 BC. 600 years later, she was taken off the map again and remained off for almost 2,000 years. Then, faithful to his promise, in 1948, God put her back on the map. Edom was totally destroyed. Israel has been restored. Verse 6. How Esau, another name for Edom, how Edom will be ransacked, his hidden treasures pillaged. When the capital of Petra was conquered, all the valuables were taken. Archaeologists who excavated the top of that rock cliff have never found anything of value. Down on the valley floor, where other civilizations later developed their capital, hundreds of valuable artifacts have been discovered. But nothing was left of Edom's treasures, just as God said. Verse 7, all your allies will force you to the border. Your friends will deceive you and overpower you. Those who eat your bread will set a trap for you, but you will not detect it. In spite of having blood ties to the Jews, Edom had been indifferent when Judah needed help. Edom's punishment now is that when she needs help, her allies and friends will betray her and drive her from the land. Verses 8 and 9. In that day, declares the Lord, will I not destroy the wise men of Edom, men of understanding in the mountains of Esau? Your warriors, O Teman, will be terrified. The nation of Edom always survived through human wisdom and strength. God will bring judgment by taking that wisdom from her. At the end of verse 10, God says you will be destroyed forever. The last half of verse 15, as you have done, it will be done to you. Your deeds will return upon your own head. God is going to judge Edom in proportion to her sin. She will get exactly what she deserves. Verses 1 through 16 are about the destruction of Edom. Verses 17 through 21 describe the restoration of the Jews. The end of verse 18 says, there will be no survivors from the house of Esau. The Lord has spoken. In contrast, verses 19 and 20 list the areas Jewish people will eventually have. As Obadiah is writing, there is no nation of Judah. No Jews are living in the land. But God gives the promise Judah will return and repossess it. In addition, when Jesus is king in his kingdom, Jews from all 12 tribes will be reunited and live throughout the entire region. God has said that he will destroy Edom, both the nation and people. Our culture always likes to know the details. What specific things did he do? When did he do them? How did it happen? Obadiah, and even the rest of Scripture, does not tell us. It is secular history that gives us the details. Edom had absolute security when Obadiah wrote in the 580s. But just 40 years later, in 538 BC, Nabataean Arabs, who had been Edom's ally, betrayed and attacked her. Half the people fled to southern Judah, leaving the nation of Edom one half the size she had been. God was making her smaller. By 450 BC, The Nabataeans had taken over the area and were in control of the king's highway. The rest of the Edomite people now moved to southern Judah. With this, Edom as a nation was gone. All that was left was the capital of Petra on top of the cliff. Because of its security, the Edomite leaders and elite people were able to hold on to it for another 100 years. I'm sure one of the reasons was that the Nabataean Arabs did not think it was urgent to do anything about them. From Edom's point of view, however, she became even more sure no one could capture her. But then it happened. By 312 BC, the Nabataeans took Petra, and now even Edom's capital was gone. So many times in history, God works in the simplest of ways. This was certainly true of Petra. Remember, the only way to the top of the cliff was through a secret passageway. When the Arabs decided to take Petra, they hid a few soldiers on the valley floor just to watch. After weeks, perhaps even months, one day, an Edomite soldier on top of the cliff dropped his helmet, and it went bouncing down the side of the cliff 1,000 feet to the valley floor. Convinced that no one was anywhere in the area, the soldier came down through the secret passage, got his helmet, and went back through the entrance of the passageway. Later, the Arab soldiers confirmed the location. They organized their troops and one night went up the passage, taking the capital Petra with little effort. With all its security, we would expect the Nabataeans to make it their stronghold. But for whatever reason, they ignored it and let it disintegrate. They and the Romans after them developed their capital of Petra on the valley floor. It was the Nabataeans who carved the buildings in the rock all around the sides. Neither the Nabataeans nor anyone else after them has ever rebuilt a capital on top of the rock cliff. Throughout the centuries, it has remained desolate just as God said it would. The nation of Edom, with its land and capital, was now gone. But the Edomite people still had a national identity. From the 500s to the 130s BC, they lived in southern Judah. Because they lived as a separate people with their own laws, the area became known as Idumea. This was the Greek way of saying Edom. But then in 125 BC, Jews under the leadership of the Maccabees took control of the land that had belonged to them in the past. They told the Edomites if they wanted to stay and live in Jewish land, they would have to live under Jewish laws. Verse 18 of Obadiah says, "The house of Jacob will be a fire, the house of Esau will be a stubble, and the people of Judah will set the stubble on fire and consume it." The Jewish people consumed Edom, so they were no longer a separate people with their own laws. Their national identity was lost. In 37 BC, the Roman Empire expanded and chose puppet kings to rule for them in those areas that were far away. The first king they chose to put over the Jews was a man descended from the Edomites who was living in the area. His name was Herod the Great. While he is king, Jesus is born. Herod the Edomite tries to kill Jesus, the Israelite. The conflict that started between Esau and Jacob, between the Edomites and the Israelites, is now in the New Testament. Herod the Great dies, and one of his sons, Herod Antipas, is put in charge. He continues the conflict by killing John the Baptizer. He makes fun of Jesus at his trial just before the crucifixion. When he dies, his son Herod Agrippa takes over. He kills James the Apostle and tries to kill Peter. He dies, and his son Agrippa II comes to power. He listens to Paul's defense as a prisoner and says, "I know he's innocent, but I refuse to give him his freedom." The conflict continues between those of Edom and those of Israel. In 70 AD, when the Romans destroy the Jews and their nation, they also kill most of the Edomites because they were living in the same area. Some, however, managed to escape to live in the surrounding area. They and their descendants continued until 663 AD, when they were destroyed by the followers of Muhammad. With this, the Edomites became extinct and totally forgotten until 1812, when Petra was rediscovered by a Swiss archaeologist. In all that time, and even today, the area on top of the rock cliff has always remained desolate. God did not destroy Edom suddenly, like he did to Nineveh. He took his time, little by little, over a period of 1,000 years. But he kept his word. Everything he said he would do to Edom was accomplished. So today, there's no people and no nation of Edom, and there never will be. However, the valley floor that was developed by the Nabataean Arabs and Romans has been restored. Today, it is part of Jordan. Roads have been built leading to the entrance of the winding gorge. It has become a tourist attraction, with 4,000 people a day visiting the area. What is amazing is that the Edomites are never mentioned. Even the guides and the people from that area are unaware it was Edom's land for 1,000 years. Many Bible scholars, including myself, believe that sometime in the future, a world leader will try to kill all the Jews in Israel. The books of Zephaniah and Revelation say that at this time of God's judgment, Jews who fear the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob will be hidden by God. It will be in Petra. With modern warfare, we know that on a human level, it is not possible for people to remain hidden for 3.5 years. But since God says he will do it, we can count on the fact it will happen. He is a God with great creativity, and in some way, he will make it possible. Historically, Obadiah is a fascinating book, but the spiritual lesson about bitterness is the most important. The bitterness of Esau against his brother affected his life and the lives of others for almost 2,000 years. The author of Hebrews, in chapter 12, verse 15, uses this story to warn us. I'm reading it from the Living Bible because of its clarity. "Watch out that no bitterness takes root among you. For as it springs up, it causes deep trouble, hurting many in their spiritual lives." We all know the feelings of bitterness. We also need to know what it is. Bitterness is unresolved anger. Anger in and of itself is not wrong. It is a God-given emotion, so we can respond to things that are wrong. All of us have experienced deliberate injustice, wrong that was done to us intentionally, things that were evil. If we are honest about our feelings, we will know it has made us angry. However, we may not want to use that word. We've been told good Christians are not supposed to be angry. So we will often use another word. We say, "Oh, but we've been deeply hurt." Whatever word we use, it is that feeling in response to wrong done against us. The feeling is anger. Now, if we think anger is a sin, we will try to ignore those feelings. We will deny them, excuse them, or what most people do, we stuff our feelings. The problem is, the feelings are still there, just buried further down. Over time, they will show up, either in our physical health or our mental health. When it affects our minds, that unresolved anger grows into a root of bitterness, which will damage our spiritual life. God has a much better way to deal with our feelings than just to stuff them. He wants us to forgive, but not the wimpy, simplistic kind that most people talk about. Forgiveness does not mean to overlook injustice, to minimize the wrong, to forget or pretend that injustice never happened. Forgiveness does not mean we accept deliberate evil or smile and say, oh, that's okay, it was nothing. That is never forgiveness as God intended. The first kind of forgiveness is to forgive as Christ forgave us. It means it is two-sided. The guilty person has to take the initiative, admit the wrong they did to us, and ask our forgiveness. That is their part. Our part is that we choose to no longer hold the injustice against them. Now, if the person is controlling or dangerous, we do not have to be their friend or have a close relationship with them. But if their apology is genuine, we have to let go of the anger by not holding the injustice against them. This comes with two warnings because not everyone is genuine. People with addictions of alcohol, drugs, or pornography, they use apologies for manipulation. They are not genuine. So after two or three apologies and then they failed, we have to refuse any more words until they change their behavior for a minimum of at least 1 year. Here's the second warning. After we forgive a person, we should still use the legal system to hold people accountable for any illegal actions, such as theft, abuse, assault, or other crimes. There have to be consequences for serious offenses. This two-sided forgiveness is all about deliberate, intentional wrong against us. Now, I am aware that many times people do things against us that are unintentional. They are simply misunderstandings. That is different. In those cases, we are to take the initiative and go to the other person. That is what Matthew 18 is all about. But when the injustice or wrong has been intentional, and both sides want to reconcile, God has two-sided forgiveness. We are never to take the initiative. The one who is guilty must come to us and apologize. The problem is, the majority of people who are most guilty will never apologize. This is why God has given us a one-sided forgiveness. We must admit we are owed an apology. What the person did to us was wrong. We can never be so spiritual as to say wrong is right. There can be no healing if we cannot say it was wrong. So we admit we are owed an apology. We then accept the fact we are never going to get that apology. They will never admit they were wrong. So thirdly, we choose to give up our right to personally get the apology. Notice, I am not saying we give up our right to the apology. That would be injustice. We give up our right to get it personally. And then, the most important for our healing, we give that injustice to God. We ask Him to collect the apology for us. We can be sure, either in this life or in eternity, that person will have to kneel before God and admit that what they did to us was wrong. Once we are sure there will be an apology, there will be justice, now we can let go of the person, event, or memory. Later, when the injustice comes back to our mind, picture the person on their knees in God's presence, admitting their wrong. And while you have that picture, thank God for the justice He is getting for you. The book of Obadiah is all about bitterness, the way it can destroy us and the people around us. We can never escape injustice in this life, but we can escape the root of bitterness by using the provisions God has made for us. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for being so practical, giving us ways to deal with injustice. Help us to be aware and honest about our feelings. Teach us how to think correctly about these important issues of anger and forgiveness. May we use this knowledge to find healing so our lives can reflect your character. Thank you. This is possible because of Jesus. Amen.